This is Sciographies, an introduction to the people who make science happen. I'm your host, David Barkley. I'm an oceanographer with the Faculty of Science here at Dalhousie University. And on Sciographies, I interview different types of scientists about what shaped their interests, their career path, and how they get their research ideas. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Sciographies. This time we're talking to Dr. Megan Bailey, an assistant professor with the Marine Affairs Program here at Dalhousie University. She's also a Canada Research Chair in Integrated Ocean and Coastal Governance. Dr. Bailey grew up in London, Ontario, with a love of animals that led her to a zoology degree. Afterwards, she spent a year studying monkeys in the South American jungle, but she found her mind was occupied with questions about local resources and how they were being used. So when she came home, she course-corrected her career path and pursued a master's and PhD in fisheries economics instead. Today, her research informs public and private policy around seafood production and consumption all around the world. Her motivations are guided by the belief that ocean resources can be governed in ways that ensure both ecological resilience and the social well-being of communities that rely heavily on local fisheries. In this episode, Dr. Bailey tells us about finding her passion, how she chooses her research questions, and what it's like to work at the intersection of ecological science and social science. I guess we can start at the very beginning. So, which is
I'm like, my you mother's were born. Womb.
Yeah, basically. Because you're from London, Ontario.
Yeah, I grew up in the city.
But you were very athletic. You are very athletic now. Were you?
Very?
I'd say, little known fact for the listeners, Megan is a very handy with a bat. I know that,
I mean, I grew up playing baseball mm-hmm. and basketball, like tennis,
no
those
hockey.
Kinds of things. No, I can't really skate.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
But it is hockey country, though.
Yes, it is hockey country, okay. For sure.
What about your parents? What were they? What were their focus activities?
My dad plays guitar, mm-hmm. and my mom likes weaving and pottery and woodworking.
Oh.
Those would be their hobbies.
Did you feel the pressure to partake in those type of activities?
So I actually went to an art school growing up.
Okay. Is it high school or?
No, elementary school. Okay. Lester B. Pearson, wow. School for the Arts. Shout out to London's Lester B. Pearson. So it was a school. It started in grade 4. It just went grade 4 to 8. And there was dance, drama, visual arts, musical arts. We took piano lessons. I played the flute. And I loved drawing. But I also really liked science and kind of the natural world. I was really fascinated by bugs. I had a bug box. And so when I got to high school, that's where, you know, it gets really tricky when you kind of have to choose, like, at that age, at 14, are you taking science classes or are you taking art classes? So I still maintained art, like visual arts, but took mostly science and maths in high school. Interesting fact that I got a 99 in grade 9 music, because most people coming into grade 9 music have never played an instrument before. So I got a 99 in music, so I didn't want to take it in grade 10 because I, you know, it's kind of a waste of time. But I still wanted to play in the choir, but they wouldn't rent me out a flute. Like, I couldn't get a flute from the school to play in the band. Sorry, not the choir, the band. I'm a terrible singer. The band, because I wasn't in music class. So I quit playing music for that reason. But I still draw and paint. I knit. I make quilts.
Okay. Are you a quilter?
Yeah.
A bit of a quilter myself.
I heard you maybe. Little known fact for the audience about Dave is he recently just co-developed a quilt. Do I understand that correctly? A gift for a
I've
friend?
I've made several gift quilts for people.
Right on.
I'm working on two right now, so it's really in my
You're working
life.
On
I'm like
two.
Very close to finishing one of them.
Good.
Just got to do the binding. That's
yeah,
it.
Good for you.
Okay, so wait, I want to go back in that list. There was more stuff. So the painting and drawing, you still...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I still really like that.
So what subject matter do you usually paint?
Now it has to do with what my five-year-old wants to paint. So we did a watercolor of the solar system recently.
Beautiful.
That was actually really awesome. You didn't realize that watercolors were like made for the solar system.
Right.
Like, it makes amazing planets with really cool like color fading in and out and stuff. So that was a recent one. We did a rose because he really likes flowers. So watercolor is new for me. So but I thought it's nice for a kid because otherwise you go through like tubes of acrylic paints.
Paints.
It's very expensive. Yeah. Watercolors last a long time. It's mostly water. So now I'm mostly motivated by things he wants to draw.
You get to get inside his mind a little bit.
He made a picture recently of an owl, a painting for a friend. It says, "To my friend Don, I love you." And I was like, wow, that's really, you know, that's really sweet. And then he made a painting for me and it said, "To Mom from Chris." So I don't know what's going on there.
He's five. He turned five in June. Well, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. Let's go back to London. You went to Western, hometown hero.
Yep. Lived at home during undergrad.
Wow.
Awesome.
You were on the scholastic road from day one.
I always did well in science, so certainly I knew I would go to university, I guess.
Okay.
But I certainly was never a lifelong university person, wasn't really necessarily the goal. But certainly from high school, yeah, I knew I would go to university.
And now what kind of science were you taking?
At Western, it was a bachelor's of science until kind of partway through. And then I moved into zoology, like an honor zoology. I originally wanted to be a vet. Animals are my thing, my jam. And so I wanted to be a vet. And I worked at animal care, so where all the kind of medical lab animals are. So all through university, it was an amazing job. And then I found out you had to write the MCAT that you have to write for medical school to go to vet school in Ontario. And I was like just afraid because in second year science, I mean, the level of anxiety from everyone that was pre-med and having to write the MCATs. And I just was like that. I can't handle that. So my dreams of being a vet went out the door because of the MCAT.
I hope some like regulators or whatever are listening to this.
And I would have been a good vet. So I took it to zoology instead because I thought, you know, that's still, then I can do kind of field-based work with animals. That love of animals still there, but more of a research, in a research capacity.
Okay. So. And you said you were working in the animal care facility. Was that like just cleaning cages or what kind of stuff were you doing there?
All the husbandry, cleaning cages. And we had everything from mice and rats to rabbits, guinea pigs, pigs. I worked like mostly weekends, holidays, making sure animals had food and water and everyone was healthy. And
did you ever develop relationships with the animals?
Yes and no. It's hard. You're so like kitted up in protective gear. So there's this really big barrier of prevention between you and the animals and like what I wouldn't give to sit and hug a monkey.
Okay. So you finished your zoology degree.
Yeah.
How did you get the idea to go to grad school? Because had you done any research to this point?
Well, so I did two research projects. I took a marine biology course at St. Andrews Biological Station.
In New Brunswick.
In New Brunswick, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a summer field course. So I came out there and I looked at the predatory behavior of whelks. So that was a kind of very small research project there. And then for my honors undergrad, I looked at the diet of mute swans on the lower Great Lakes. So
are you cutting open swans? Are you looking at swan poop?
No, yeah, stomach contents.
Okay.
Yeah.
All that type of experience, that was what motivated grad school?
The immediate motivation was a biogeography class I took in my fourth year.
Okay.
And we talked about island biogeography, and I was obsessed with lemurs. And decided I wanted to study lemurs in Madagascar. So I decided I wanted to be a primatologist and applied to do a master's with a man at the University of Toronto. So I went and I met with him. I wrote a kind of a proposal and he said, this isn't a master's project. This is a career in primatology. You have to, you know, think about what question you can answer in one field season with a monkey or a lemur in this case. And so we kind of went back and forth and he said, you know, maybe you should get some field experience. I was finishing up at Western and he said, you know, I have a colleague who works in Suriname, which is in the north of South America. But I have a colleague working there with brown capuchin monkeys, and she needs field assistant. Why don't you think about doing that? So I hadn't finished the mute swan work yet. I had to take that back up when I got home. But I left London and flew to Suriname. My friends at the time were like, you've lived at home until this very day. And your first choice is not to get an apartment on your own, but to move to the jungle by yourself to work in a remote field camp.
But you had all the experience with the monkeys. You weren't afraid of the monkeys.
Well, I wasn't. Oh, no. I certainly wasn't afraid of monkeys.
You wanted to hug them.
Exactly. This was my chance.
I feel like in the wild, you have a better chance.
Than a laboratory setting. Yeah, much better chance.
Okay. And did you end up doing your PhD with this?
So I spent that year and realized primatology was not for me.
Okay, so wait, hang on a second. You spent a year in the jungle.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in a protected area called Raleigh Fallen. And we studied a troop of brown capuchin monkeys called Starbucks. I don't know who named them. And every day we'd go and find them and we'd just have to write down what they were doing, grooming or feeding or traveling. I mean, there was a couple of reasons why that really wasn't my thing. I mean, one of them was related to the subjective nature of those observations. Yeah. Like sometimes the monkeys are really 25 meters up in a fig tree and they're there all day. And every 15 minutes, we have to say what they're doing. Sometimes we're using our binoculars trying to say, oh, Peanut's grooming Raph. And then it's like, ah, do I really know that's Peanut? But also, we were in this protected forest, and I came down being like, we need to save the rainforest and understand these monkeys. And then I got there, and there was people that lived near where our field station was who had to cut down the trees for their home, mm-hmm. fished in the Copanama River for their food, ate our monkeys. And it was this total awakening of, wow, who do we save the rainforest for? Or mm-hmm. who has a right to use resources? Or what is the kind of that human dimension of resource use?
Right.
And I happened to read a book while I was there by Daniel Pauly, who's a fishery scientist at UBC, and read a little bit of work within that book that he had cited, Rashid Sumaila, who ended up being my master's and my PhD supervisor. So
at UBC.
At UBC.
Yeah.
Read that book. Wrote a letter because I was in the jungle to inquire about doing master's work with them. I took a year off after the monkey work to take first year economics as a 24-year-old.
I was going to say, you had just this science background at this point, but you're looking at the world from a bigger lens.
Yeah, a very different lens. So I took first year economics, and I took two other courses, like a political ecology class, finished the Mute Swan work.
This is all back in London.
This is back in London, yeah. So back at Western. And then in 2005, in the fall, flew to Vancouver to start my master's.
And you did PhD there as well?
Yes, yeah.
So I did my PhD. So you were there for quite a while.
6 years, yeah.
From London to the jungle, you had this epiphany about what this work, why was this work important, or why was it misguided?
Yeah, my positionality with the things that I thought were important in the world, and like who am I to say the rainforest should be saved versus who has a voice in getting to use that rainforest.
So then you move out to Vancouver. What was your graduate student experience like?
It was incredible. I was part of the program was called Resource Management and Environmental Studies. And so it's an interdisciplinary unit. My supervisor was an economist. I took an economics lens to my work, but I was also kind of exposed to a number of different disciplinary kind of lines of thought and methodologies and methods.
Yeah, so you had this economic lens, but I noticed one of the key methodologies was game theory.
Game theory was an important way that we try to look at the way, in this case, different countries operate when they share a resource. So there's strategic interaction when countries meet.
And you try and quantify those strategic interactions?
Yeah.
And write algorithms that play out, or?
Yeah, exactly. So you develop a model. You know, you have different players, and presumably your players are asymmetric. So one of them has, you know, certain characteristics about it that the other players don't have. And then you have to figure out, where do those players intersect? So where is the dynamic externality that, like, what you do as a player impacts my decision making? And for us in fisheries, that's at the level of the stock, the population of fish, right? So what you choose to fish takes away from what I can choose to fish. So where you fish, when you fish, what you fish, with what you fish, like what gear you use. So then we have a model that brings our players together, and they kind of compete for the resource, or they work cooperatively for the resource. And then our questions are usually around, you know, is the resource better off? Is the fish stock better off if we cooperate? Generally, yes, it is. So that's what game theory would predict. And what we generally see play out is that when we have highly competitive fisheries, you know, it's not good for the population of fish. It's not good for the profitability of the fishery, that kind of thing. So we know cooperation is good. So then we say, well, how do we get countries to work together?
To get, you know, the different players to work together, obviously you have this model of the game, and then you design, I guess, the algorithm, the interaction in some numerical way that comes as a positive outcome.
Yep.
But then you have to take that numerical scheme and turn it into real life actions or real life policies. How do you do that?
You don't. That hasn't happened. So that's part of kind of my disillusionment with that. And I still get asked to review papers, you know, that are game theoretic models. And the conclusions are almost always the same. Cooperation is better. Cooperation is better.
So really, we learned everything from the classic 1980s movie War Games.
I'm not familiar. Sorry.
It's where a child hacks into like the DND supercomputer and they simulate nuclear war. And then the computer runs a million simulations and then goes, the only winner in nuclear war is no one or something like that.
Yes. Okay.
It's a great movie. Yeah. You've had this interesting track where you went from, you kind of become a true intellectual, if you don't mind me saying so.
I don't mind.
In the sense that you're thinking big picture, you're very interdisciplinary, you're probably reading lots, writing lots. So where did you see your career going as you finished up your PhD?
Part of my PhD work was funded by WWF. Mm-hmm. Wrestling Federation. Worldwide Fund for Nature. And I was really captivated by this giant global NGO. I had been kind of privy to some of their strategic planning. So I became really interested in that, in strategic planning and logic models. So I kind of thought maybe I would end up working in the NGO space. It was never this clear, I want to be an academic. These are the steps I need to take. But I applied for a bunch of postdocs and then jobs. And the one I ended up taking was, like, I couldn't have written a better postdoc because it was almost half project management and half research. I thought, oh, I'll develop all of these skills that would be really helpful if I wanted to work, say, at WWF, but I'll also still be continuing to do research if a research career is what I'm interested in as well. It was about tuna in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. That was with the Environmental Policy Group at Wageningen University in the Netherlands.
So at this early point in your career, you've already had this epiphany in the jungle, and you're thinking very broadly about scientific research, sort of considering the impacts to and the involvement of people in these problems. So how did that play a role in steering you through these kind of career junction points?
I didn't know it at the time, but at Wageningen, we had this T model about breadth and depth. And this is kind of like a tension, right? Is how deep do you go in a discipline and how small do you make your question so that it's measurable and it's, you know, very clearly defined? And how broad do you go to understand what is the social context, the political, mm-hmm. institutional context, the cultural context in which your work is being done? And so it just seems that the opportunities that I was given, the courses that I took, the mentors that I had, there was both of these things, mm-hmm. at the same time. It was, you know, I can build economic models and I can justify all the crappy assumptions that we make. But I was also working, you know, a lot in Indonesia and recognizing why those assumptions don't make sense and recognizing why decision making isn't just taking the output of a model and turning that into policy.
Yeah. What are your strategies for navigating that world? You gave this example, you're doing work on tuna fishery in Indonesia. You're going there. How did you balance, you know, your research findings with your experiential findings?
So I had done some field work during my master's in Indonesia, and that my PhD was almost kind of desk-based, other than a few meetings and a little bit of data collection in the Philippines. And then my postdoc, I had a lot of field time. And having spent a bunch of time in the field as a postdoc, I look back on my PhD and I think, oh, I would have written that so differently had I had spent more time in the field. So I think it is important because I see in my writing, like I think back to being in London and I think about the naivety in some of the science that I did or the models that I made and the ideals that I thought I had about how a system should be managed. And then spending time there, realizing, well, number one, it actually doesn't matter what I think, right? I have absolutely no, and I should have no say in how Indonesia manages its fisheries. So if that's the case, if I recognize my positionality in regards to who actually has a right to make decisions in Indonesia and who has a say, then I become more of like a support infrastructure rather than a driving research force. So now I think my questions need to be tied to that outcome. So what do I hope my research contributes to? And for me, it's about increased equity. It's about participatory governance. It's about the outcomes of fisheries management and who they benefit. So my questions have to be tied to the limitations of decision makers in terms of what it is that they actually can control. For us now in social sciences, we often try to take what's called a participatory or action-based research approach, where we're constantly in the field and in communication with partners and everything's collaborative. You can't be an island and do participatory research, and it's all iterative. So this becomes difficult from the scientific kind of model and the funding of like that everything's supposed to be laid out at the beginning. You know, this is my hypothesis, this is my method, and you can't do iterative participatory research in that way. It changes based on what your participants and partners want, the political reality. I've been working in the Indian Ocean on fisheries allocation, tuna allocation, like which countries get what. And South Africa has had a change of president and leadership. Kenya has had two elections. Maldives has had a change of leadership. The delegations change, the political alliances change, the goals of the government change. When we think back about the models that tell us countries should work together, maybe that happens in a moment in time.
Right.
But there's so much transition in governments that those political realities have a huge influence on what we can achieve in conservation and equity outcomes. And if you don't spend time at those meetings, if you don't follow the political process in those countries, you have no idea. And you have expectations about how a country should operate. Those aren't your expectations to make. So it becomes really difficult.
Right. That's tricky. So you don't want to be telling people what to do ever.
No. No.
Yeah.
No.
At the same time, you do a lot of writing. The contents of that writing, I'm assuming your ideas and your opinions are in there, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think the impact of your writing is?
Right now, I think it's mostly just trying to foster conversations and bringing in different viewpoints. Because my background is kind of at this nexus of fisheries management and economics and environmental policy, a lot of that conversation has always been about how much fish is in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And how much fish can we take from the ocean? I don't think that's a question that we need to ask anymore. I think that made sense 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But now the question is, who's taking that fish? Who's eating that fish? Who benefits? Mm-hmm. What are the kind of the necessary political preconditions to allow equitable outcomes? Those are conversations that have really kind of been taking place over the past 5 years, I would say. And so I feel like my writing is in that space of just trying to get fisheries managers to recognize that there may be other objectives than just maximum sustainable yield. So
right.
getting the most fish we can catch out of the ocean.
Right.
And then the other part of my work, I think, and my writing is speaking to this idea of who should participate and who has a say. And a lot of that comes not to necessarily just how much fish do we take from the ocean, but who's eating it and who has a say in how it's produced. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge geopolitical situation around seafood where a lot of the seafood we import in the developed world comes from the developing world. So as the US, Canada, the EU, Japan, as we put conditions on how fish should be caught, of how seafood should be procured. What we're really doing is operating in a dynamic of power, saying how other people should manage their fish, how other people should live their lives, who should get a job and who shouldn't get a job. I think we're coming to realize through that line of inquiry that there's issues with that.
Yeah. What kind of conditions are we talking about?
So, for example, if we look for eco-labeled seafood here in the supermarket, you can find labels that are supposed to be indicating to a consumer that that fish and seafood is sustainably caught. Well, what that means is that it's met a set of standards around the ecological sustainability of that, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, except that that discriminates against maybe a fishery or a country where there isn't a lot of government oversight and where fishing is really important because there's high unemployment. There's, you know, not a lot of other livelihood opportunities, particularly in like island nations. And so now we're saying we don't want to buy your seafood because you don't have good fisheries management in place.
And that's simply like mostly this maximum yield type criteria, right? So if they're not observing how much they're taking out of the ocean, for instance, we don't consider it eco-sustainable or
whatever. If you don't have the data. So if you're not collecting data to know how much fish you're catching from the ocean, then you'll never get a label that says that's a sustainable amount of catch, right? Or that that gear is sustainable. So we need a lot of data to make kind of claims and verify claims around something being sustainable. So that becomes a problem because we know data collection is really expensive. And I mean, if you just even look across Canada, there is not a lot of publicly available data on our fisheries, on most of our fisheries. That's true a lot of places. And if those data are not collected or made public, then those fisheries get dropped out of the global market, basically. Mm-hmm. From an ecological sustainability point, that might be a good thing. But again, if we think that we care about fisheries, not just for the fish, but for people and jobs and livelihoods and culture, then we don't want to exclude necessarily those products from our market just because they don't have the data to prove that they meet our level of standard. Again, who has a right to determine how that fish should be caught?
You say this type of conversation is only about 5 years old?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's older in the literature and some of the scholarship, but in terms of standards, like fishery standards and eco-labels actually caring about it, that's much more recent, and governments actually paying attention to criteria. A few years ago, the Associated Press broke a story on seafood slavery and found out that there's a ton of indentured labor and slaves basically operating on fishing boats. So even if you get a logo on your product that says it's ecologically sustainable, right, some of that slave-caught seafood was ending up in Whole Foods in the U.S. That kind of put the social conditions, the labor conditions on government
radar.
That
ecosystem doesn't involve human
well-being. Yeah, exactly. It doesn't. Yeah. So those are kind of newer conversations recently.
Seems like there's a parallel between that and other societal issues that are at the forefront right now. Like, for instance, gender dynamics or social dynamics, intersectionality.
Yeah, and anthropological and ethnographic. And I mean, I'm hopeful maybe that there's some kind of critical, like a reckoning of the fact that we're all people, whether you're a consumer of seafood in Canada or a fisherman in Indonesia, we're all people. Mm-hmm. We all have rights and we all want to have participation and a right to say something in our life. And that's this idea of self-determination, right? Is that an Indonesian fisherman has some right around his livelihood, more of a right around his livelihood than we have in determining how he should live his life and how he should fish his fish. I think it's really about putting people at the center of the conversation.
But should people always be at the center?
I think it really depends on what your objective is, right? Yeah. And so if you're interested in biodiversity conservation, that's fine. Then maybe people don't need to be at the center. But if you're talking about fisheries management, why manage a fishery if it's for the fish? If the fish is what you care about, you don't have a fishery, right? Mm-hmm. You leave the fish in the ocean. So if we are choosing to take fish out of the ocean, it's because of people. It's because we want to employ people and we want to feed people. So how can we not have people at the center of an industry that is created around delivering goods and services?
Like, a lot of your work is read by people who make important decisions.
My work is relevant to regional fisheries management organizations. Yeah. So groups of countries that come together annually or a few times a year to manage tuna fisheries, basically shared tuna fisheries. Yeah.
So you have policy people and stakeholders that care about your work. Does the public care about your work?
I think that my work in terms of like access to fish and seafood as consumers and access to local fish and seafood, because that supports our communities as well, that really matters. You know, I get asked all the time from friends and family, like, what fish should I be eating and what's good and what's bad and what's sustainable and not. So I certainly feel like there's a huge public interest in that. And I think just 2 weeks ago, I was interviewed for Chatelaine magazine for a story on sustainable seafood. And then I got a call the week later for another story of a U.S. magazine on seafood sustainability as well. And always the question is, what should we be eating? What should we be eating? So I think there's huge public interest in that line.
So people do care enough.
I think so. Yeah.
You think so? Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. The people I talk to.
Well, that's good. That gives me a little bit of hope, because I feel like the message is people maybe don't care.
Yeah.
Or we get these doom and gloom messages. For instance, that all the seafood will be taken out of the ocean by, 2050 or whatever.
Yeah.
But you feel hopeful.
I do. There was a recent, I think it was in the Guardian UK maybe, and it was an article saying that to save fish, we need to just stop eating it.
Right.
Oh, man, the pushback to that from the scientific community that works on food security, on livelihood security, on culture was huge. That's not the solution. What I work towards is a future, where my grandkids still eat fish and seafood. That's what matters to me. Mm-hmm. Certainly you need an ocean full of fish in order. Well, that's not true, actually. We could just synthetically create all of our fish, but it might be possible. But what I would like is an ocean full of fish so that my grandchildren eat fish.
Yeah.
Or could be a fisherman if they choose to harvest fish. So that's what I work towards, and I'm certainly hopeful that future exists.
Thanks to Dr. Bailey for joining us this week on Sciographies. In our next episode, we'll be talking to Dr. John Goss, a geologist who studies landscape evolution in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science here at Dalhousie. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to subscribe to Sciographies so that you're notified when new episodes are made available instantly. And please consider rating and reviewing us. I'm your host, David Barkley. Thanks for listening. Sciographies is brought to you by Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science and CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The show is a legacy project that came out of Dalhousie's bicentennial anniversary celebrations in 2018. Our producer is Nicole Killowee. You can learn more about Sciographies at dal.ca/sciographies. We encourage listeners to visit projectdal.ca/bluewhale to learn about Dive In, the Blue Whale Project, a Dalhousie initiative on ocean conservation.